Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Sheckman. From Watergate to Iran-Contra to 9/11, the phrase, what did they know and when did they know it, has become a mantra of political analysis. In no arena is that question more powerful than it is with respect to the events of 9/11 that took place 14 years ago. Today, new gleaming skyscrapers have risen next to Ground Zero. The wars in the Middle East have gotten worse as a result of post-9/11 actions, and surveillance of U.S. citizens in the name of homeland security has never been greater. George Bush sits and paints, while Dick Cheney is once again pushing for war, this time with Iran. But the psychic scars of 9/11 remain, not only for the families that have suffered loss, but for a nation that has once again suffered the loss of truth. Few have worked harder to understand those events and get to that truth than Professor Peter Dale Scott. On this anniversary of 9/11, we sought to give Professor Scott an opportunity to talk at length about one of the fundamental consequences of 9/11, the implementation of continuity of government planning, or as it's come to be known inside government, the Doomsday Project. Fundamental to Scott's ideas is that we have a secret government that no one is allowed to see, that not even President Obama has been able to change, and that has undermined the very notion of constitutional government. Scott believes that it's clear that we've had a cover-up by the military on 9/11. Peter Dale Scott is the father of deep politics, a view that looks at the network of power and influence within our government, a world seldom discussed. A former professor of English at Berkeley, a former Canadian diplomat, and the author of several critically acclaimed books, including Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, Drugs, Oil, and War, The Road to 9/11, and most recently, Dallas 63. It is my pleasure to welcome Peter Dale Scott here. Peter, thanks so much for joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Well, I'm always glad to be connected to Who, What, Why.
Well, it's an honor to have you. One of the things that you write about is that in order to really understand some of the issues and some of the actions that took place on 9/11, that we need to look at the bigger picture, the link between things like 9/11, Iran-Contra, the election of Reagan, the Kennedy assassination, Watergate. Talk first about that linkage.
I'll just focus on one of the chief connections, which is the fact that sometime before the last plane hit the ground on 9/11, they implemented something called Continuity of Government Plan, COG. And, you know, in the first analyses of 9/11 right away, not much attention was paid to that. And then when I wrote my book, The Road to 9/11, when I said that these plans, COG plans, had been implemented, two favorable reviews said that I speculated that I did this. No, it says very clearly in the report that the plans were implemented. The trouble is that the phone call which implemented them is missing, but that's probably because it was on a secure COG network. Now, why is COG so important? Because it was being under continuous review by Rumsfeld and Cheney since 1982 in the Reagan administration. At a time when, well, eventually neither of these men were in the government, and yet the plans were very sweeping. They were described in 1987 as plans for the suspension of the U.S. Constitution, and I think in some respects at least that was true. Now, your question was what links this 9/11 to these other events? And the answer is that you look at the Kennedy assassination, you look at Watergate, you look at Iran-Contra, and then finally at 9/11. 9/11 was the first time that these plans were implemented, the only time they've ever been implemented. And by the way, they're still in force. At least they were in force as late as 2007, and I don't think there's any reason to think they've gone. And they are, in the little we know about them, they were described again back in 1987 as involving warrantless surveillance. Well, that clearly was true. I mean, that's what Edward Snowden has so clearly revealed. Warrantless detention, And that happened in a big way right after 9/11. Something like 1,000 Muslims were rounded up without any warrant, without any limit on how long they were kept. Some of them, I've talked to a man who actually, he was a Shia from Iran, a professor, and he says he was tortured. He was beaten to the point that there was blood in his urine. So that's pointless detention. And the third thing that happened is they said in the 1980s, martial law. That hasn't exactly happened, but we now have military involvement in homeland security. We now have a military command, NORTHCOM, that is overlooking Americans in North America the way SOUTHCOM is overlooking Latin Americans in South America. So this is a pretty extreme thing. And in all these other events, Kennedy assassination, Watergate, and very, very much in the case of Iran-Contra, the instrumentalities of 9/11, they had set up a special network outside the government networks. And that's the key to really what Oliver North was doing in Iran-Contra. He could send arms to Iran using people in the U.S. Embassy in Lisbon without the ambassador knowing, because he was using what they call the Doomsday Project, which was the special communications network for COG. My latest book tries to show how that same COG network was played a key role in the events of the Kennedy assassination. And just very quickly, I mentioned Watergate. Two of the key personnel in Watergate, James McCord and John Dean, were both, by their own admission, part of the 9/11, I keep saying that, the COG, Continuity of Government Planning Network. So there's this planning network that is a common denominator to all of those events, what I call deep events. A structural deep event for me is when something major happens, like 9/11, and it's so important that it has to be investigated, and the investigation doesn't provide the answers. It is clearly signs of a cover-up, which is another sign of just how important and well-planned the deep event was.
If we go back historically, what do we see as the origins of this continuity in government planning?
It begins very legitimately back in the 1950s when America was using atomic threats and nuclear weapons threats. And now that the Soviet Union also had nuclear weapons, they began planning what to do if America was attacked by a nuclear weapon and it hit Washington and effectively decapitated the U.S. government. So, you know, you have rules of succession, the president, the vice president, the speaker of the House, secretary of state. Supposing all those people were killed in one atomic attack, you really did have to have planning to deal with it. And so it began in a legitimate way. Eisenhower did something which, in the end, I think was going to have major consequences, though it wasn't wrong in itself. He said he put in charge of the planning people who were not in government. This is where I talk about the deep state, people who are powerful enough to plan for emergency planning who are not in the government. They were part of the deep state. And one name I know from that period was Frank Stanton, the head of CBS. But it's much more relevant to 9/11. The plans were somewhat put to one side by President Carter, but very much revived under President Reagan in 1982. And by the way, this is by a secret order. Congress knew nothing about it. And he also put people not in government in charge of it, one of whom at the time was Donald Rumsfeld, who was head of a drug corporation. And by the 1990s, the plans kept going right through Reagan, Bush, Clinton. And by the time that Clinton is president, two of the key figures are now Rumsfeld and Cheney, not in government, with the president from Eisenhower. But with the big change in the 1980s under Reagan, is originally this was to deal with a nuclear attack. And then they formally changed it under Reagan to deal with any national emergency, and they defined emergency in a presidential executive order to cover things that were whatever, in effect, whatever the president thought was an emergency. And the proof of this is that 9/11 was not an atomic attack. It was an emergency, legitimately enough. There are no laws involved here. All of this is outside the constitutional frame of government. On the basis of the COG plans, they implemented the plans. And, you know, here's a 9/11 commission report that's supposed to look into the bottom of it. It concedes that the plans were implemented and says in a footnote that they didn't go into them and that only the top personnel of the commission were even allowed to be briefed on the COG plan. So you have something that, in effect, is trumping the Constitution and doing it without any kind of constitutional authority. And the key event is not the beginning of it under Eisenhower, when it was quite legitimate, but what happened with Colonel North. He was, by the way, the executive officer for this COG planning. He was asked about it in the Iran-Contra hearings. So Congressman Brooks said, is it true that you've been planning for the suspension of the Constitution? You'd think that's a pretty important question. And the chairman said, we can't go into this here. If the Senate is going to look into that, we'll have to go into executive session. And we've never heard if there was an executive session or not. That, I think, is totally illegitimate. It was something happened under Reagan, which was asking for trouble. And 9/11, I think, has to be viewed in that context as something which happened. The most important thing which happened on that day, I believe, was the implementation of COG plans. One of the conditions of COG planning, a legitimate one, is that in times of emergency, the president and the vice president should not be in the same place. And that's why, of course, President Bush, he flew on that morning. He was in Sarasota, and he flew first to Barksdale in Louisiana and finally to Offutt, which, by the way, is the base for many special programs. Didn't get back till late in the afternoon. And at that point, the vice president left and went off to be inside one of the hollowed-out mountains near Washington, which is part of the COG planning. That's why they developed these alternative government sites underground near Washington. And Cheney spent the next 90 days with a staff, a big staff, about 100 people, inside one of those mountains. What was he doing? I think I would guess he's putting the final touches on the Patriot Act, which is, I think, came out of all that COG planning. That's why I say it's important to look at 9/11, not just in terms of what was happening in the president's bunker or the details of how Building 7 at the World Trade Center went down, but to know that there had been these really quite major plans, which were essentially plans to change the way we live. And we still have the warrantless surveillance. And I'll bet you we still have the warrantless detention, although there has been some statutory action on that. And we certainly have the militarization of security. This is a permanent change to the United States. There is now a permanent U.S. brigade stationed, I think, in Ohio, which is there in case demonstrations, like possibly anti-war demonstrations, get so big that they can't be handled by the local police. Those sort of things, military intervention, we had them in an emergency basis before, back in the Detroit riots of 67, things like this. But this is not, this is permanent. We have been permanently changed in these respects.
Going back to the morning of 9/11, what do we know about the way this continuity of government plan was immediately put into effect after the first plane hit one of the towers?
Well, I have to be a bit vague because the report is clear that it was implemented, but there are some important phone calls between the president and the vice president, which are, they asked for records of all the phone calls, and they got complete sets of records, and these phone calls are not in the records. And my explanation for it is that they were using the alternative network that I referred to before, the Doomsday Project, they called it, inside the Pentagon. I think we can time it within a certain period. The last plane went down shortly after 10, maybe 10:03, maybe 10:07, there are different accounts. But there's a 10-minute period between about 9:44 and 9:54. There are many accounts from people like Andrew Card, who are with the president, and who say that, you know, they got a threat there in Sarasota, so as a result, they speeded to the airport, that's true, and then immediately took off. And the report tells us, and I believe it, that that's not true. No, the president waited for 10 minutes on the ground, even though they knew there were Al-Qaeda-type terrorists in Sarasota. And now you go to the vice president. He himself told NBC that he had gone to the bunker, in the PEOC, we call it, the President's Executive Operations Center, that he went there before the Pentagon was hit, which would be before 10:34. And the report has him coming into the PEOC at 10:58. Where was he for 24 minutes? The report refers to him using a telephone in the tunnel. I don't think it was a phone booth. I think there was another operations center, and there was another center, a COG center. Anyway, the report concedes that he used it to make a phone call outside the PEOC, so we're going to that higher level of planning. And then finally, the most extraordinary thing of all is Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. There is a National Military Command Center. He should have been there by his own account, and you can see it on TV. He spent a bit of the time out in the courtyard after the Pentagon was hit, helping put people on stretchers. It's clear that the nation is under attack. We have a National Command Authority, which is the President and the Secretary of Defense, and not, may I say, not the vice president. And here's the Secretary of Defense when we're under attack putting people on stretchers. Well, he also, if you look at all the different things he said, he was obviously in some room, not the NMCC, the command center, talking to Cheney and talking to the president. It's amazing to me that this is the same part of the report where they say that they were on the ground for 10 minutes. The president made a call to the vice president. Why to the vice president? The nation is under attack. You have a national command authority. Rumsfeld is part of it, and Cheney is not part of it. And he makes a call, which is unrecorded, to the vice president somewhere in those 10 minutes. Either between two of the three or all three, they, I am sure, implemented COG, because it is clearly in effect when the president takes off and doesn't come home but goes to Barksdale, that's because of COG. So I think we can deduce that when his plane takes off at 9:54 a.m., COG is, well, then or very shortly thereafter, COG is now implemented. And that means that the government that we live in has been changed and is still changed, and we don't even know what those changes are. Can I tell you something else? You know, in 9/11 truth people in Oregon were quite powerful, and they got Congressman DeFazio, their representative up there, who sat on the Homeland Security Committee in 2007, for him to, when President Bush announced in 2007 that he was renewing the state of emergency, and he was and that there were secret annexes with some COG rules, they said, you should find out what the rules are. And the administration told him that he couldn't see them. Well, he's on the Homeland Security Committee. And so the chairman of the committee, in a written demand, said, we have to see those annexes. And they were told, you don't have the clearances to see those annexes. So we had a secret government which not even Congress, not even the special committees of Congress, is allowed to see. This is a terrible situation. And now we are also, I'll throw in one last thing. The National Emergencies Act of 1978 is a post-Watergate reform from Senator Church, who found out that the nation was in a state of emergency and most of the Congress didn't even know it. So they passed a law which said that if in future, if the president declares an emergency, Congress shall review it within 6 months. It's not an option that they may review it. They shall renew it and either affirm it or let it go down. Well, we have had a state of, actually two states of emergency ever since September 2001 because of 9/11. And so the National Emergencies Act kicks in, Congress shall review it. They've never reviewed it. And when a group of us, I and a former congressman, appealed across the country, get your congressman to do this, and one of the people was told by his congressman, he said, oh, well, that law has been superseded by, guess what, by the continuity of government rules. So if that's true, this is an explicit example of how the Constitution has been superseded by COG. And, you know, we were hoping maybe Obama would stop extending this emergency, but no, what began in 2001, we're still in a state of emergency. And if there's anything that citizens should do, they should appeal for the emergency to be lifted and for Congress, at a minimum, to examine it and see why it's important for us to have warrantless surveillance and all these various things that go with it.
Going back to 9/11, you mentioned before the president leaves Florida. He winds up at Barksdale Air Force Base in New Orleans and then goes to Offutt. What was that all about?
One other aspect of COG which is relevant to 9/11, and that is that if Washington is under attack, they have provided for a special plane. It's an E-4B, which is a kind of government in the air, and has its own. It's part of the Doomsday Network. It can you can from this plane you can, in effect, do anything you you can control the government. It's set up. And it's for either the president or for the Secretary of Defense. Obviously, neither of them were in an E-4B on 9/11. But what is very interesting is, you know, there's prohibited airspace above the White House. And no plane ever goes there. And if a plane tries to go there, it gets too near, it gets shot down. That's very clear. But on that day, 9/11, at about somewhere between 9:30 and 9:45, Anderson Cooper for CNN reported seeing a E-4B over the White House. Now, you can tell an E-4B because it's like a regular B-747, except it has a pod on top for communications to come in and go out. And so it's distinguishable. And we actually have footage from CNN and you can see the plane, and it clearly has that pod. So you had an E-4B over the White House on that day, which is not talked about in the report or explained in any way. Now, what is special about Offutt? Offutt is the base for the E-4Bs. And I'll just say very quickly, there are four of these E-4Bs, or there were in 2001, and at least one of them is in Washington, probably two of them were in Washington, and now we have this Major Darling, who, Robert Darley, you might want to remember that name, and Google for his talk in Iona, where he says a lot of amazing things. He says it was a low-flying plane right over the White House, so low that he was in the executive office building next door. He could hardly hear, he could not make himself heard to the man next to him. That's not the E-4B that Anderson Cooper saw, which was way up in the air. There's a case that it may possibly have been a third one. I don't want to go into the details, but his talk is very interesting because he contradicts the report on a number of items. Particularly, he says very clearly that there was a shoot-down order issued by Cheney, who had no authority to do this, in the PEOC, the president's bunker, and they thought they had shot down United 93. So that if they thought that, it was clearly prior to the plane hitting the ground. And, of course, many of us think the plane was hit by a missile, but that's a secondary issue, I think. The important thing is that the report is clearly contested on many important details by many of the people who were there, like Norman Mineta, the Secretary of Transportation. It's clear we had a cover-up. It's clear we need to know what really happened. And I wish the American people could get their collective wits and will together to insist that something as important as this shouldn't just be pushed to one side by another commission report like the Warren Commission. We need to know what happened. We need to look very closely at the emergency which was proclaimed. And we need to get to the bottom of it and get back. This is not a very radical thing to say. We need to restore the constitutional government that has made this country great.
Do you think that too much time has passed to be able to go back and piece together exactly what transpired in this operation on that day?
No, I think the contrary. I think that it took time to begin to discern the outlines of what really happened and to look at the COG part of 9/11 in the context of COG and other events and so on. You know, this is the question that's asked all the time about the Kennedy assassination. And, of course, we've lost now nearly all of the important eyewitnesses to the Kennedy assassination. But at the same time, it's taken years and years, and it's still happening. But we're beginning to get documents declassified that should have been declassified decades ago, which are pointing to, that's my next book. It's going to be out at the end of the month, Style of 63. I look at some of these declassified documents, and we see that Lee Harvey Oswald was playing an important role in the files of CIA, FBI, Marine Intelligence, Office of Navy Intelligence. In other words, he wasn't the disgruntled loner, the ignored man that was presented in the Warren Report. There were beginning to get documents declassified in 9/11, and that is the key, I think. There are lots and lots and lots of documents still to be declassified. And the more we look at it, the more we begin to get a quite different picture from that in the 9/11 report. So, I think this is fundamentally a healthy country, and it's still possible for people to do that kind of research, and it's still possible to pry these documents out of the government if enough people demand it. And so I think the important thing is to get the man to know what really happened on that day, and then we will learn.
Do we think that the 9/11 report engaged in actively covering up some of this, or simply did not have the information available, that the information was designed to be unavailable to the people putting the report together?
Well, I think you have to look at it on many levels. First of all, they were denied the COG material. I mean, the staff was. You have to distinguish between the commission and the staff. And it's the same was true with the Warren Report. The staff, some of them were very conscientious, and some parts of the staff reports were going in the right direction. There's a book by Philip Sheehan about the 9/11 report and commission, where he shows how staff drafts of the report were then rewritten at a higher level. I have to name the name of the executive director, Philip Zelikow, who played a key role in this. And particularly, there was a great deal about Pakistan, which would have been very damning, but it got withheld at the end. It was, I think, part of the deal. You know, Musharraf brought Pakistan in on the side. When President Bush said he was not with us, is against us, Musharraf had to decide to be with the Americans, and that was a pretty shaky alliance, but I think part of the condition of that alliance was that the damning stuff about Pakistan didn't go into the report. Saudi Arabia also, I mean, probably many listeners know it. There's 38 pages of the joint inquiry in Congress that is still suppressed, although we have a pretty good idea it's suppressed, because it's pointing to ways in which Saudi Arabia was involved with some of the alleged hijackers. So that, yes, they got some information and were not able to process it clearly. But ultimately, you know, it was very, Bush and Cheney were very, very reluctant to have a commission at all. It was supposed to have been a non-governmental commission, yet nearly all of the staff were FBI and Justice Department. I mean, it was absurdly close to the government. Zelikow had done a book with Condoleezza Rice, who was the National Security Advisor. It was anything but arm's length from the government, but even so, it did some good work. The Warren Commission did some good work. It just didn't end up in the report. 9/11 Commission staff did some good work. It just didn't end up in the report.
Where does the CIA stand with respect to these issues surrounding continuity of government as it relates to 9/11?
Oh, that's a very good question, and I can't give you a very good answer. I think, first of all, may I say, one of the things, I say it's useful to compare these deep events, structural deep events. We now know for a fact that the CIA was very much involved, more involved in the career of Lee Harvey Oswald and the reporting on Lee Harvey Oswald and on actual events leading up to the assassination than anyone knew at the time. Now, in the case of 9/11, I can't give a same kind of clear answer like that. The CIA is not the only powerful covert operations agency we have now. Starting in, I think, 1980, we've had the Defense Department has had its own strategic command. JSOC, with its own agency. It's a parallel CIA inside the Pentagon, and there's been a big, now that we're having these drone attacks all the time, there was kind of a turf war between the CIA that wanted the budget for the drones and the Pentagon that wanted the budget. I have to say that basically the implementation of COG planning has from the beginning been more on the Pentagon side. There's been huge budget for this alternative communications network, billions of dollars, something like $8 billion. And because it was all hush-hush, very secret, it also became very corrupt. And there were, improprieties, illegalities in the awarding of contracts. And you had a congressman sitting in on the planning, and then his son eventually went to jail because of his abuse of the contracts that he was awarded. So you asked a question about the CIA. That may not be the most appropriate question with respect to 9/11. You would want to know what secret agencies were involved in the implementation. And my guess would be that JSOC had more to do with it than CIA, but I don't know. You asked a good question, and my answer is I don't know.
To what extent do you think that Cheney and others will ever reveal any of this as time goes on, or will be forced to reveal any of this?
Well, I said in 2006 that Cheney has contradicted himself on some very important issues, like when he got to the president's bunker under the White House. And he should definitely, of all the people, he, number one, should be put under oath and say, look, you've given out two different stories. They're incompatible. Tell us under oath which is true and why you didn't tell the truth before. There is such total unanimity among the leaders of our country not to get into this, starting with Senator Inouye back with Congressman North. Inouye was a liberal Democrat, but he wouldn't allow Congressman Brooks to ask a question about the North planning for suspension of government. The Democrats were in on it. That's because we have these oversight committees, and they approve these things, and once they approve them, they're responsible for them. That was one of the church reforms, and not a very successful one, I think. It's just put Congress more in on the secret, and therefore on the cover-up. There's not a whisper. I mean, why wouldn't Obama let Congress examine the conditions for the emergency? There's no discussion of this at all. I knew one congressman, well, I'd met him once, Congressman Kucinich. I thought he was, as congressmen go, about as good as you can get. I couldn't get him to answer my phone calls, my emails on the question of COG. It's just too sensitive for all of them. There may even be penalties that we don't know about for anyone in Congress who uses the initial COG, I don't know. So is it likely that Cheney will have to do this? I don't think very until we have some major change. But should he? I think if you believe in the importance of constitutional government, and if you recognize that what we have now is at least a threat to constitutional government, if not an actual overriding and suspension of constitutional government, then yes, of course he should. Anthrax, I haven't talked about the anthrax. If anything ever called for a major investigation, it's the anthrax thing, and the FBI went after a couple of individuals, but they haven't explained why top people in the government were shouting anthrax before the anthrax attacks occurred. New York Times is warning everyone about imminent anthrax attacks. Then we got the anthrax attacks, which on the congressional level went after two Democrats. These were supposed to be people in Iraq, you remember, angry Muslims, angry at Bush, but they attacked the two people, Leahy and Daschle, who were holding up the passage of the Patriot Act. And because of those two attacks, we got the Patriot Act, and we still essentially have it, though it's slightly reformed. All of that is screaming for investigation, and the constitutional health of the country requires that investigation. It's up to the American people whether or not they're going to insist on that kind of investigation.
Peter Dale Scott, his upcoming book is Dallas 63. Peter, I thank you so much for spending time with us on Radio Who, What, Why.
Well, thanks very much, Jeff. You obviously done your homework, so it's nice to talk to somebody who has.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
I hope you'll join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shackman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share it and help other people find it by rating and reviewing us on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.